Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I'm here again, and I'm looking out the window at my bird feeder, and there's three of them hanging out there, and the one on the right has a little downy woodpecker on it and is sharing it with a goldfinch. Yesterday, a great blue heron visited us, and as we were sitting on our front porch, it flew around the house from the little creek and back. It was like a pterodactyl coming by so close. Now I got a grackle. They're big and noisy and scary. And the blue jay, and things are busy out there. It's feeding time at the Breggin Preserve. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. You're listening on PRN.FM. And if you are listening on August 28th, which this is, 2019, 4 p.m. New York time, you can call in because this is open mic day. Open mic day. You can talk to me about anything. You can ask me anything if I can't answer it or I tell you I can't. But it's your day to ask questions about anything you want, and call in early so that you can get on the list, and then I'll make an estimate at some point for when we have filled the list for the afternoon. And so call in now, get yourself lined up, let me judge how much time I can give each person by knowing basically how many callers we have today. Call in at 888-874-4888, 888 874-4888. And the show is archived on Breggin.com, Breggin.com. And I appreciate the growing number of emails on BregginLive@Hotmail.com. The only place I talk about this address, BregginLive@Hotmail.com, is on a radio show. So in that sense, it is dedicated to my radio listeners, to my wonderful, wonderful radio listeners. So keep that in mind, BregginLive@Hotmail.com. And I appreciate all the calls. It's been a response to my asking for folks to tell me, do you you want to hear more about some political ideas and thoughts I have? Want me to stick to the psychiatric issues, which have, of course, what have made me whatever fame around the world that I have, and probably account for much of the good I've done in my life, talking about psychiatry and children and how bad the drugs are in general for people. And I'm getting stuff from both sides. One, that the folks are really glad to hear me as a reasonable, loving voice in this arena, and others saying not that they want me to shut up, but they're worried it will distract from my political, that being more political will get me under a lot more new attack and perhaps distract from my voice within the field of psychiatry, mental health. I want to continue to hear from you on BregginLive@Hotmail.com, and I appreciate those of you I've written in just this week about it. Remember that the PRN.FM has an app, and using the app, you can listen from anywhere in the world, I guess, on the app. I don't know a lot. I don't know a tremendous amount about those things. And remember that the best way to stay in touch with what I'm doing in the psychiatric arena and what things I think are worthwhile that other people are doing just to hear some positive things as well as critiques that we have our daily breaking news. My assistant Ian, some direction, not a lot from me and Ginger, puts up interesting stuff all the time. In the last few days, he's got a number of interesting articles up on nature and exercise and self-talk, the nature of self-talk, and how it can be helpful to you, and other things we don't talk much about that can be helpful in terms of how to have a good night's sleep. He's also got some interesting articles on the growing awareness of the harmfulness of antidepressant drugs, a new article from Europe discussing the delay and now hopefully some increased recognition to psychiatric drug withdrawal, especially antidepressants. That's the focus of this particular article, with some of my friends co-authoring from Great Britain. Another article that people taking antidepressants have a threefold increase in their relapse, not when they stop the antidepressants, during taking the antidepressants, a threefold increase. So a lot of interesting stuff on the website. Don't forget 123antidepressants.org. Don't forget 123antipsychotics.org. Big free resource centers on antipsychotics and antidepressants. Today I want to introduce my own thinking. I always talk a little bit about something on my mind while people warm up to calling in to ask questions. And I thought I'd address one of the really thorny and difficult issues. I think it's thornier and more difficult than probably even the politics, because it's an underlying theme of political viewpoints. And that is, what is personal responsibility, the R word? People are so burned on the idea of personal responsibility. They so associate it with being made to feel guilty when they're kids. They so associate it with being told to do things they don't want to do. They associate it with authoritarian religions. That the language of personal responsibility becomes offensive. So what other words do we have? Self-determination. That's another way of looking at it. Knowing that you can make your own decisions. Personal sovereignty, that you know you're in charge of yourself. Another very important concept, very similar to the others. The exercise of free will. Knowing that you have free will, knowing that you can exercise volition, choice. So we've got free will, volition, choice, the idea that we can choose different ways of thinking, we can work on different ways of feeling, that we can strengthen that ability as a mental muscle, strengthen our brain as an organ that we humans can actually exercise. Now, the opposite of all of things, of these things, there's we could look at it in two different ways. What is the opposite of personal responsibility, personal sovereignty, autonomy, self-determination, taking things over for ourselves? Managing our own lives. What's the opposite of this? And one way to look at the opposite is that it is being controlled by others and by circumstance. So as painful as at any moment it might be to say, I've got to get my act together, I've got to not cave in, I've got to not get overwhelmed, if we don't get our act together, then we are controlled by other factors in this world. We're by our moods, controlled by the weather, by political fears, political propaganda, by an upset or angry family member, by a boss that we really wish we could leave and we can't, or a boss we really want to ask for a raise or improved conditions at work or an advancement. We become under the influence of other forces to the degree that we give up personal responsibility, personal sovereignty, self-management, autonomy, all of those things. That's one way to look at it. If we don't do it, somebody else will. And there's always folks that will. Some of them are con people. Some of them are aggressive people. Some of them are manipulative people. It's just, some of them are loving people and who somehow feel enabled when we're not taking care of ourselves. So that's one of the major dilemmas of life. As painful as it can be, or as humiliating it can be to admit there's an issue, or however guilty we feel about the whole subject and can't think about it, when we don't just move in and take charge of our own lives, other people do. I suppose even our pets. I notice there's constant tension in our house between when the dogs want to eat and what schedule we have them on. And those of you who have dogs and maybe cats too do the same thing. You call in and talk about that. They keep whittling down the time between feedings. They get hungry an hour earlier or half an hour earlier. And before you know it, you know, you've compromised 5 by 5 minutes because of that soulful look of the paw on your knee or a little whimper. Our dogs don't whimper all that much. So you end up whittling the time down. You're actually giving up your sense of control of the world around you to the dogs. That happens here. That happens here all the time. Always there are forces willing to move into our space. And it can be, they can be good people and loving people. And if we just leave that vacuum there, they get sucked into it. Almost like it's a force. Almost like when you're feeling helpless, it's a force that pulls people in. And that brings me to the second point. The first big point is about the importance of taking charge, that dreadful R word. The second is that if we don't take charge, other people, other animals, life circumstances, everything else is out there ready to take charge. The underlying issue, another perspective on it, is that we lapse into helplessness. Helplessness, the vulnerability to feeling helpless, I believe, is universal in every human being. It's from our childhood. It's the basic, what I call in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, it's the basic negative legacy emotion. We have feelings of helplessness that are built into us through evolution. So that when we're children, if we feel hungry or if we feel lonely or cold or something's bothering us, we go into helplessness and then we signal to the adults around us who hopefully will then take over, check things out, pick us up, rock us a little bit, snuggle us. Maybe look to see if there's something climbing on us or if we need to have a diaper change or whatever. And this has been since time began, that the nurturers, usually the mother, even before we had language, the female nurturing us at a very early age and taking care of us when we felt helpless and when we felt dependent. And there's a tendency to hope as adults. I've been through this. I'm very familiar with this from myself. It's still there after all these, years. That feeling of, oh, I just like to be helpless and have somebody help me out here. It doesn't work very well. It can work in some ways. Let's say you're feeling really upset at a loved one and angry and you don't want to go there. You might say, well, I just don't know where else to go. Can you help me? I'm feeling like I don't have good alternatives here. Help me out. But that's really not helpless. That's saying, join me. Join me in helping me and you to get back on track to being loving and taking care of each other. So very, very important not to lapse into a state where other people will take over for us whom we don't want, or even worse, we'll get diagnosed and put somewhere for acting helpless. If you're somebody who verges on walking around looking helpless, you're in constant danger. The risks of assault go up, of being physically, sexually assaulted, being panhandled, just being bothered go up the more you look like you're helpless. And the more you look like you're independent and in charge of yourself, those things diminish. And I'm not talking about walking around looking angry, because that in itself is a signal of, on some level, feeling helpless and can attract people to you to harm you. So this is a basic outline of some of these issues. If any of you want to talk about it more, it'd be good to have you call in. I'll return to it some more. I think it's a very basic key to life to at all times be alert to what you can do. Now, let me say one more thing about it. When we're in a love relationship, or when we're working with or taking care of children, when we're in relationships that require a lot of responsibility, it's very easy to resent others, the other person, if we don't feel they're doing as much as we are to create and handle the relationship. It's a tough decision to make a decision. I'm doing too much. You're not doing enough. And it may be necessary at some point in a marriage or a partnership or a friendship or at work to say, I want you to do some more in this area or that. I'm doing too much. But to say to a loved one, I reach out to you, it seems like a lot. I asked 3 times today if you'd like to spend some time, and you said no, or you didn't even respond. I need you to reach out to me and to respond to me reaching out to you. It's a very difficult line to draw. Interestingly enough, when you sit down with couples and things are difficult for them, both usually feel that they're carrying too much of the weight. I can give you one piece of advice from a lot of time around these issues with myself and other people. In a good relationship, both people are working really, really, really hard to take responsibility. That is, both people feel like they're handling a bit more of their fair share. So keep that in mind in your relationships with other people. I'm going to go to Julie, old friend of the show, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi. Formerly of Massachusetts. How are you doing? Thank
Hi.
You for letting me on. Thank you. It's funny. I'm just finishing up my book now, and it's going to be published by the end of the year. And it talks a whole lot about responsibility in my book. The title of the book is Life After Lithium, and I've got you know, I don't have a chapter specifically on responsibility, but the whole book is about that. And it's about that it really is a joy to be given responsibility, because as mental patients, we were not. That the right to take responsibility was taken from us. And we were told we weren't good enough. And so a lot of people, you know, they hesitate to take responsibility, or they're afraid to, or they think they can't do it. But the truth is, you know, you probably can. And when you find out finally that, you know, you're being asked to take responsibility or take on a role in a group, or, you know, you have to take care of your house and you didn't before, well, it's a joy. It's because finally, you're being trusted to do those things, and trusted that you'll be able to, and seen as competent. Because when we were mental patients, we're not seen as competent. We're not seen as capable. And so I talk a lot about, you know, getting the diagnosis, getting away from the diagnosis, not thinking about yourself as a mental patient, and not hanging out with anyone who thinks of you as crazy.
I think all that's very, very, very important. With this book, you said you're finishing it. Will it be available at some point to people?
Yes, you can already sign up to be notified of when it is available. I have lifeafterlithium.com. I set up that website. There's a page on there where you can sign up, and if you do, you'll get free information on how to treat kidney disease with natural medicine. It's just a list of 10 things you can do to improve your life if you have kidney disease, especially if it's from lithium. You know, live the very best life possible. Another big news, I have a television show that I have just started doing. It's my own syndicated show, and the focus is, well, I mean, human rights and anti-psychiatry. And I'm not at the point yet where I'm taking guests, but I will be in the future. So anybody out there interested, please get in touch with me. And I have the show has a website also. It's juliemadvlogger.com.
Juliemadvlogger.com.
Vlogger. My other site is Julie Mad Blogger, but it's Vlogger with a V, V as in Victor. So I just, that's the name of the show, is the Julie Mad Vlogger Show. And it's just taking off, and people are showing interest. And it's shown on Netflix, Hulu, a lot of other stations, and really all over the world. And I'm so excited because it gives me a chance to talk about anti-psychiatry and the things I believe in, and, you know, explain that the diagnoses are bogus, etc.
And that's Julie Mad Vlogger, V-L-O-G-E-R?
No, two G's. Two G's.
Vlogger?
Yeah,
all right, so instead of a B, it's a V, like...
I have both of those sites. Actually, both of those sites.
Okay, great. Well, that's wonderful, Julie. Can you say more about your own experience in coming to grips with taking charge of your life? How did you do that? Because if you were in a mental hospital, you must have, for a time, I imagine, lost that ability.
I completely lost it, yeah. I was forced onto disability, told I couldn't work, never told the scientific reasons for why I couldn't work. So, you know, it was interesting when people, why can't you work? Why aren't you working? I had no answer. Absolutely no answer. The only thing I could say was, well, the doctor says so. But that was pretty lame. I think that was really lame. The first thing I did was relocate. That was absolutely essential. I had to get away from where I was. I left the country. I lived abroad for 2 years. And during that time, I went through incredible financial hardship. I just didn't have enough money to live on. And, you know, I ended up, well, I learned how to, for instance, make a fire to keep myself warm, or wash all my clothes by hand, which I still do, live without a stove, without a refrigerator, without a hot water heater, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, you can do these things pretty easily. And I just
got Julie, you were in Europe at the time you were doing that?
I was in South America. And where I lived for 2 years, and finally I just completely ran out of money, and my wallet was stolen, and I was homeless, and I finally came back and started over again, a third time. Yeah, second time. Started over, and with just a few suitcases and my dog, and he finally, you know, started applying for jobs. He said, why can't I work? Of course I can work. And so I put in, I would say over a long period, probably about 200 applications before I finally got a decent, you know, I had one job that was just terrible, so that just fell apart. But then I just got, I got a job. I was just working my job today. And I got a second job just recently. Well, I had another. I've gone through a bunch of jobs, but there's one main job that I've kept this whole time. And I'm also starting substitute teaching. So it's like all of a sudden everything's just kind of exploding in a really wonderful, positive, fantastic way. And it's really nice also to be employed, because then you get money. And money does make a difference. I don't care what anybody says, it makes a difference. If you don't have enough to live on, you're going to be constantly worrying, constantly struggling. But when you have just enough, get over that hump, it is so liberating. It really is. And paying bills, for me, it's a joy. It's a joy to just say, okay, I earned this money. Here you go. Have it. And it feels very, very solid, very good. And, you know, I've made mistakes too, and that's a joy, because I learned from my mistakes, biting off more than I can chew, trying to take on too much, trying to do too much, trying to set deadlines that are too soon. But every time I make a mistake, I learn from it. So I got all this learning now, because I made a lot of mistakes.
Very inspiring, Julie, to listen to you and to your determination. Did you call in because I had sent out my frequent alert saying I was going to talk about responsibility today?
No, you just happened to talk about it. I said, oh, wow, that jives with me, you know. Yeah, I mean, responsibility, if you're not given responsibility, then it's an insult, as far as I'm concerned. If that responsibility is taken away from you, then somebody's not treating you very well. I mean, and when they put you on disability, when they lock you up, when they tell you you can't do this, you can't do this, you're so incapable, you're so insufficient, you're so needy, you know, they're stealing from you the right to have a responsibility, the right to care for yourself, the right to make your own decisions. And, you know,
how old, Julie, were you? And if I ask you anything too personal, just say, never mind, Pete, I don't want to talk about that. But how old were you when you were first locked up?
Oh, I first walked into a therapist's office. I was 23 years old. I did it voluntarily, only because my former, you know, it was 1981. So I had heard about therapy kind of vaguely from my former employer, and he kept saying how great therapy was. And I found out otherwise, but it was a gateway to the system. But then I went to day treatment, and by then I was getting real indoctrinated in the jargon of you have this illness, you have that illness, and I said to myself, what do I have? I don't know. But then I had this really rotten anti-Semitic therapist, and this by then I was 24 years old, And I just got worse and worse with him. And finally, my roommate said to me, well, if you go to the hospital, at least they'll give you drugs. And I said, okay. And I went, because I wanted drugs. Specifically for my eating disorder, they did not work. But I kept going back for more, thinking they don't have the right drugs. They don't have the right drugs. And 35 years later, I still had an eating disorder. They had never even addressed it. And I'd been on the worst cocktails ever and found out at age 55 that I have kidney disease from lithium. And a lot of my life now, well, you know, I don't really dwell on it too much, but I'm very, very careful what I eat. I have to be. I do things to help my kidneys. And I have been, I would say, for the past couple of years, sustaining them at the same level. They have not gotten worse. And my plan, and people get bugged about this, but I do not plan on accepting dialysis. And, you know.
Why not, Julie?
It's a decision based on my research on dialysis. My desire not to be cared for, not to be touched by medical personnel because I was abused in a hospital a couple of times. My desire not to have half my life centered around basically institutionalization at the dialysis center. And I don't want it. I don't want it in my life. I have a great life. I have a great life. And my kidney disease is bordering on stage 5 right now. And I am fine because I do all natural medicine.
Well, keep taking good care of yourself. I actually don't know enough about dialysis to even discuss it in a very sensible way. And perhaps somebody who is listening, the phone number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, knows more about dialysis.
Well, anybody who took lithium better start thinking about it, because when you take lithium, as soon as you start taking it, your creatinine starts to go up. It's almost across the board, every single person. That your doctor might tell you, you have nothing to worry about, keep taking the pills, but to tell you the truth, I personally was not told I had kidney disease, even when my kidneys failed, even when my kidneys were at stage 3, probably for about a decade or half a decade, I was not told I had kidney disease. And I don't think they tell people. I don't think they tell people who are perceived as mental patients. And I think anybody out there, if your doctor is telling you your blood levels are just fine, don't even believe it. Ask to see the blood levels. Ask to see what your creatinine is, which is usually the most basic measurement of how your kidneys are doing. And I list the symptoms that I started having at stage 3 in the book: muscle cramping, like really painful Charlie horses, swelling in your legs, swelling in your ankles, very itchy skin for absolutely no reason. These things are all signs of kidney disease, and I'm not saying that any one of these means you have kidney disease, but if you took lithium and all of a sudden you're having really bad muscle cramps and leg swelling, please get your kidneys tested, and don't expect them to just tell you. Go and look at those numbers.
I think that's all very, very good advice. I mean, some of the early signs, you know, people do get a severe thirst. They end up carrying a bottle with them everywhere they go.
Yeah, that's usually diabetes insipidus, which is related to kidney disease. But that can come. I got that after a couple months of lithium.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed with me. Even after I stopped the lithium, I still have diabetes.
I've had a few legal cases, Julie, where I represent. I was the psychiatric medical expert for people who had kidney disease. My expertise was not about the kidney disease, but about what doctors should do to monitor and inform patients. And I know of other cases like yours, just to confirm that for our listeners, where people were had their kidney functions markedly reduced and getting worse and worse over time, and doctors never commented on it in their medical records,
they never told the client about. I think most doctors don't. I think that's the way they do it. They don't tell you. They think you can't. I don't know. I wrote in my book. I don't know. Did they think I couldn't handle it? Did they think I was too mentally disturbed to possibly get a grasp on it? Or did they think that's just what happens to mental patients? Who cares? She's worthless. She's not working. Who cares? You know, it was one of those, or a combination of the three. They don't think we're worth it. They don't think we're worth killing. We're subhuman to them. So, most doctors will not tell you. I mean, you'd have to really confront the doctors. I did confront my doctor one day. I said, please, 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 give me a blood test. Something's very wrong. And she didn't.
You know, it's that issue of responsibility that doctors, psychiatrists in particular, I think more than other doctors, often just avoid taking responsibility for the harm they do. They just ignore it.
Exactly.
They pay no attention to it. It enables them to fly through their days with a clear conscience. I mean, some of these questions I think are unanswerable as to why people perpetrate in this manner. But it certainly happens a great deal in psychiatry, and it also happens throughout medicine to some degree.
It does to some degree. When I was in the hospital for kidney failure, they did not tell me. They told me it was because I was a danger to myself, believe it or not.
Wow.
That doesn't really make sense. Can you explain? Can you explain? And they wouldn't. And he just said, you're a danger to yourself, and he wanted me locked up for good. Not so great, and I got away.
When do you take any drugs now? I suspect not, but do you take any psychiatric drugs?
No, I just have to take something to get to sleep, because when you have kidney disease, your body can't really make melatonin. I've been trying to, what I'm doing now is cutting down and cutting down and cutting down. And get the, you know, I want to be on the absolute least amount possible. I don't actually, probably shouldn't say this publicly, but it doesn't matter.
If you have questions, think about it before you say it. Go ahead.
I don't tell any doctors, you know, that I ever took psychiatric drugs. I don't tell them. And I keep it to myself, and I generally don't see doctors at all, don't really need them, make my own decisions, that's it.
Yeah, and that is a very common feeling and an attitude and action for people who have been so abused in the psychiatric system. And I do think that it's a real issue and I'm glad you brought it up. I'm not afraid of that issue. It's very dangerous to tell physicians that you've been on psych drugs or you're seeing a psychiatrist, because there's always a risk of
they won't take you seriously, and they'll start with the eye rolling and the fake compassion and all that stuff. I don't want it. They'll treat you like you're a subhuman all over again. I don't want it for myself. I don't want to admit I was ever psychiatrized. I don't want to be re-psychiatrized. It could be forced on me, and it can be forced on any person out there. You don't know what's going to happen. And, force is not pretty. Force is horrible. I don't want to be thought of as, am I? I don't want to be thought of it as that. I don't want to be seen as a person who is so-called mentally incompetent as I used to be. That was horrible. It was horrible being treated like that. It was horrible going to my church and telling my minister, you know, I was deprived of water in the hospital and I almost died. And he just kind of, he didn't believe me. And no one in church believed me because I was so-called crazy. I would never go back to that life. I don't
want
it.
Well, it's also that they can't believe doctors would be that bad or callous.
Yeah.
And doctors in hospitals often are.
Not possible.
You know, they often are callous in ways that are very unfortunate. So nurses can be, because the people they're dealing with are genuinely in a difficult place in regard to taking care of themselves just by the nature of being in a hospital. And you have to really summon every ounce of energy you have. In fact, I recommend that if anybody is going to a hospital for any purpose, that they always take a friend. Always have somebody stay with you in the ER.
I wish I could always have somebody stay in touch with you on the ward. Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I think having somebody with you, it would really, really, really protect you. You have a witness. They have that witness in the room with you because the witness can detect any, you know, can verify for you any inconsistencies. Because if they are calling you crazy, you have no authority anymore. They will not listen to you. They will not believe you. You can say, the place is on fire. I think we all better leave. They won't leave. They'll laugh in your face.
It sounds like you've had a lot of really bad experiences, Julie.
I
always feel like apologizing for being a psychiatrist when I talk with someone like you with so many bad experiences. And it's not uncommon in the psychiatric system for people to have those kinds of experiences. And if you're in a psychiatric system, folks, you really need to get yourself together enough to get out of it, the system if it's abusing you. You really need to be able to think to yourself, what do I need to do to get free of this system?
Exactly. In my book, I say that one of the things you got to stop doing is stop calling yourself disease words and stop using their vocabulary to describe your experiences. Use your own words. I mean, and once you start doing that, you literally do think differently when you stop calling yourself a disease. And you realize you're really not any different from anyone else, and you shouldn't have been segregated. I mean, psychiatry is a great segregator, and you really shouldn't have been segregated in the first place. You realize that none of that should have happened, or most of it shouldn't happen. And I know some people do have good experiences, but the longer you stay in, I think it just gets worse.
It's so important what you just said. Don't call yourself a disease. That's really deserves a frame around it, a couple of stars and trumpets, Julie. Don't call yourself a disease, folks.
Some people, though, once they get away from the system, they start borrowing other diseases because it's so hard to not be sick. Because we have been sick for years and years and years and years and years, and suddenly, okay, it's not valid anymore. Whoops. What am I going to do? And I have known people that just go latching on to other diseases. And you got to be aware when that starts happening, it stops yourself from doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Julie, because, how long have you been outside the psychiatric system?
They keep borrowing it. 2013 was my last shrink appointment.
Good for you. And you're managing, I mean, you're really developing your personal responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I know who I am, too. And I found out that I'm really an okay person. You know, I really was okay all along. And, I mean, I was a great student. I was admired by my classmates. And they were shocked that I said I was you know, going into therapy or whatever. And it's 35 years of my life that should not have happened, but it did happen, and now I'm making use of those 35 years to tell other people, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to, you know, call yourself words that basically say you're inferior, because you're not.
I really appreciate you, Julie. Aww. I really, 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 really appreciate everything you're saying. Folks, the giving of drugs for psychological, social, and spiritual issues leads to this kind of mental patient career that Julie is describing, and that she had to really go through a lot to get herself off of that railroad to hell that it becomes. And I really admire you, Julie, for coming on the air and talking about all of this. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, why don't I sometimes give drugs? Why don't I ever do that? Give medications. One of the reasons is that, let's suppose we could even figure out a situation in which taking a few weeks of a drug might, at least by the person receiving it, feel like it helped them. Well, first of all, because it begins this path. It begins the path of, I want to be just dulled. I want to just not have as much feeling. It begins a path of, I can't work this out. I can't do this with Peter Bregan. I can't do it with anyone else. Neither he nor me or anybody else is going to be able to handle this kind of situation. So it's so disempowering to both the participants. It's both the doctor, the prescriber, and the patient are drawing into what I originally started out the show with, which are these feelings of helplessness. The therapist's help, the doctor, the prescriber's helpless to do anything safer and better. The patient's, you know, too helpless to find other help. Sometimes I talk to therapists and they say to me, well, this patient was getting nowhere in therapy. She was getting worse, so I refer to the psychiatrist. And I'll say to them, well, I want you to think about this. Isn't that kind of like giving somebody a roofie when a date isn't working out right? Isn't that something like being in a situation where instead of saying to the other person, well, maybe you don't like me, that's okay. Maybe you don't want to spend a lot of time with me, that's okay. Instead of putting something in their drink so they stay with you. I want you to think about it. Maybe that seems like a really gross analogy, but it's actually been a very helpful one to people. Because therapists get indoctrinated into the concept that somehow they are therapy. And if they don't help, therapy doesn't help. I mean, you'd have to be God to be able to say that. I am God. I haven't helped you. There's no other resources. I don't think there's a God like that. I really want you to think about it. If therapy didn't work, quote, with somebody that you went to, that's not much different than going out on a date and it didn't work. Or trying to make a friend, forget dating, trying to make a friend at the office and it didn't help. Or going to a relative and talking to them and it doesn't help. That doesn't mean you can't get help. That doesn't make you unresponsive to therapy. It just means that relationship didn't help you. Means nothing about you needing drugs. Nothing whatsoever about you needing drugs. I can't overemphasize that. This is such a shameful thing that we have palmed off on people. You know, the FDA now, I hope, makes me hope that there's a hell sometimes. The FDA device is bureau, and it's very relevant to what Julie went through, is now said that ECT is approved. They finally come out and approved of it, I think in response to a legal case where I was the medical expert, where the manufacturer finally admitted to get out of the case after what I wrote for the judge about brain damage from ECT. And the judge said, yes, this is convincing enough to give it to a jury. I'm not going to stop these people, you know, our side, from taking you to a court, to a trial. And they folded. The manufacturers of Thymotron Somatics folded. So right away, the FDA came to the rescue of the ECT manufacturers and said, we now approve ECT for treatment-resistant people. Didn't say anything more. Who is treatment-resistant? Somebody who doesn't respond well to drugs and knows it? Somebody who doesn't fake getting better on drugs? Or somebody who realizes the drugs are making them lose their sexuality or their spirituality or their ability to love or losing their tempers on people? What does that mean, you're treatment resistant? What about people who just get lousy help, which is now very common in psychiatry, because all they do is give out lousy help, which is the pills. So I just want you all to hear this from me and remember it. The fact that somebody tells you that you need more drugs or ECT, or your therapist says you need to see a psychiatrist, just say no, that is not the answer. And then don't get yourself in trouble. Quietly find another therapist or a friend or a spiritual guide. Reevaluate what you're doing. Read some good books and self-help. But don't accept ever that, quote, you're treatment resistant when the treatments make people sicker. I bet that rings so true for you, Julie. Julie, you there? I think I lost Julie.
Yeah, John. Yeah, sorry.
Hi. I didn't tell you I was going to come back to you. I apologize for that.
Because I was washing the dishes.
You're washing dishes. Wait a minute. You're on the air with Peter Bregan.
You can't go off and wash dishes. And keep the dishes clean.
Yes. It's a part of being responsible. It's part of taking care of yourself.
I should hope so. The sink doesn't get too full, only a little full. Only half full, right? Or maybe half empty.
Were you able to listen to what I was saying about...
Yes, and I thought what you said about date rape was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And in fact, I said to myself, I got to do a show. I got to run with that analogy and do a show just on that one analogy. If that's all right with you.
Yes, it's wonderful with me. I mean, anything anybody does to spread the information. You know, there's something so much about psychiatry and many psychotherapists that is very, very undermining of free will, independence, another word I didn't use before, supremacy of your own ability to reason and to make choices. When I was in my residency, I wrote a paper on authoritarian techniques in psychotherapy, how to look for them, how not to do them. And as residents, we were allowed to get our papers typed up by the typing pool. And the person who typed that paper happened to be the assistant to the department director, and she gave him the paper. And the department director called me in and said, you can't publish this paper. It was quite well written. And he didn't tell me there was anything wrong with it. I asked him, why can't I publish it? He just said it's inappropriate, or very, very vague. But he was letting me know he was pretty angry. And I said, well, you know, I don't understand how you can stop me from publishing anything. And he said, and I'm very pleasant. I learned really early, just be pleasant. Be responsible for your own conduct, Pete. Be pleasant.
Sometimes he said, nothing well, you to do.
he said, well, you can't publish it under the department name. I said, that's fine. That's fine. That was the end of it.
Did you publish it?
Well, the interesting thing was, of course, he didn't have to stop me from publishing it. The journals did. But eventually, I did actually incorporate it into it, or one of my earliest papers that did get published in the journal called Psychiatry. And the title of the paper, by then I'd learned to sort of present things that so that they could be accepted enough, you know, to be handled while being absolutely honest at the same time. And the paper was called The Ethics of Psychotherapy. And you can find that on my website by going to the scientific papers, The Ethics of Psychotherapy. And in it, I talked about, among other things, the kinds of things that are done in therapy that I feel are unethical. And it so upset people that I think they let a rebuttal get published, which is very unusual, a rebuttal to it. But it was such a poor rebuttal. I mean, it was just terrible. I mean, it was the essence of the rebuttal is, we all respect the autonomy of patients. We all respect it. How dare Dr. Brackett say we don't respect the autonomy of patients enough. So I persisted. I've done a lot of persisting. That's a part of taking charge of your life, and it's a part of being being there. Oh, my gosh, Julie. Wonderful guest, Julie. Thank you, thank you. Would have been a slow day without you. It's a dog days of August or something. Would have been a slow day, though we have good listeners, good listening audience today. Thank you for being my guest today. Essentially, Julie, you were my guest today. What do you think of that?
Oh, that's cool. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it very much.
Yeah. I appreciate your participating, Julie. Go ahead. Say what you want to say.
I appreciate that you're letting me on, and my dog appreciates it, too. She's been staring at me the whole time.
Thank you, Julie, very, very much. Folks, I think a really important and interesting show. It's the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and a caller, Julie, was my guest today, and a very, very good one. Thank you, folks. Keep listening. Have a wonderful day.